read a certain way, every story in the gospel is about resurrection. Consider this one from Luke. There was a certain man with two sons. As the parable of the prodigal son unfolds, the brothers fall into familiar categories. One is favored and naughty. The other is dutiful but angry. The younger is a rogue who asks for the disposition of his inheritance immediately, stretching the limits of familial affection. "Give me the portion of your substance that falls to my share," he demands in language that makes the impact of his request painfully clear. "Give me your being, your essence, yourself." The father's response? He, quote, "divided among them his life," one translation says. Significantly, the elder is, quote, "scrubbed clean" in the parlance of its first century audience. He is uptight and self-righteous and convinced that the father's gifts to the prodigal must be a detriment to him. Blessing is limited, according to this family's old story. True to form, the younger son squanders everything and crawls home hungry and humiliated. But while still a long way off, the father runs to his lost boy and covers his shame with kisses and his own best robe. "We must make merry," he exclaims without judgment, "because my son was dead and lives again." The older brother has stayed put, running the family farm, but he calls himself a law-abiding slave who never got thanked for his efforts. "Never did you give me a goat so that I might make merry with my friends," he remarks. "But when this son of yours came, you killed for him the fatted calf." What's a parent to do? The situation described in the parable, though not unknown, is not the norm. And arguably, the situation reflects poorly on the father and both children. The father has behaved in a foolhardy way, putting his family's honor in jeopardy. And the prodigal, in requesting the right of disposition, has in effect pronounced his father dead. If we were looking for blame, then both the father and the younger son are at fault. Not surprisingly, many modern hearers side with the elder brother, who labels his parents' behavior cheap grace. Most would agree that the gift of inheritance must be earned. But the elder brother's anger confirms our suspicions about him, too. If he considers himself a slave, well, he has put himself in that position. If he is envious of his father's generosity, he has himself to blame. But in a surprising twist, the father comes out to this boy too, who's lost in his own way. "Child, you're always with me, and everything that is mine is yours," he tells him, not a slave, but a companion and a co-owner of the farm. What kind of father is this, who acts as a mirror for his children, loving them for who they are, even as they fall short of who they could be? The parable turns all our expectations on their head. Rather than perpetuating a limited economy of favorites, from God's perspective, both sons are invited back home. Each is lost, and both are found, and two selves become one. The younger son violates the moral code, and he gets a feast. The elder son rejects the father, but he gets all. So in God's dream for us, the quality of mercy is not strained. Inheritance may be limited, but forgiveness has no bounds. And that is true resurrection. Henry Ward Beecher was an electrifying preacher in the late 19th century at Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, New York. In those days, when public lectures were as popular as Mr. Barnum's circus and Jenny Lind's concert, the best speakers were well-paid celebrities. Hundreds of Manhattan residents climbed on board early morning ferries dubbed Beecher boats to hear his sermons, and by Tuesday, his addresses were published in the newspaper. Beecher was a rock star. He also had feet made of clay. In case we're thinking that the foibles of the famous and the not-so-famous people have changed in the last 150 years, in 1870, those same Brooklyn newspapers, which heralded his rhetorical skills, began to report on Reverend Beecher's extramarital affair with a parishioner. At first, his prominence helped him deflect the allegations, but in time, the truth of the infidelity and betrayal were too well known to escape. One author describes Beecher's painful reckoning from the inside out. He writes, "On January 31st, 1872, Henry Ward Beecher traveled to Yale to deliver the first of the Beecher lectures on preaching, an honor which had been established in the memory of his father, who was another prominent minister. He'd had a bad night, wasn't feeling well. He went to his hotel and got his dinner and lay down to take a nap. At about 2 o'clock that afternoon, he got up and he began to shave without having been able to get at any plan for the lecture that he was going to deliver in 1 hour. Just as he had his face lathered and he was beginning to strop his razor, the whole thing came out of the clouds and dawned on him. He was a fraud. He dropped his razor, he seized his pencil, and he dashed off what he knew he had to say. Afterwards, he cut himself badly, thinking it all out. I don't think it's any surprise that the old preacher might have cut himself with his razor, because the inner world that the lecture was going to come from was the deep trouble that he was in inside him, and the deep trouble that he was in his world. The gossip about his relationship with the wife of one of his parishioners had left the whispering stage and was beginning to appear more or less directly in print. Compromising letters were being handed around and tearful confessions made. People were taking sides. Charges were being formulated. A public trial was not far off. And it was not just his reputation and career that were in danger, but in some measure, it was the church itself. Everything that he said he believed in and had come to Yale to talk about. So when he stood there looking in the hotel mirror with soap on his face and a razor in his hand, he finally saw himself, his own shame, the sight of his own foolishness, the self-judgment that may be even harder to bear than God's, because though God is merciful, many of us have a hard time believing it. And none of us is very good at showing mercy on ourselves, much less on each other. You see, I think the gospel is often bad news before it's good news. And that is facing the reality that we are flawed and wounded and capable of the worst kind of betrayal and selfishness and pride. When any of us look in the mirror, all in a lather, the way Beecher did that morning a century and a half ago, we're likely to see, according to Frederick Buechner, equal parts chicken and phony and slob, mixed in with hopefully some of the good parts about ourselves. Does that sound familiar? You're looking in the mirror, and there's some chicken, and there's some phony, and there's some slob. And some of us get so stuck in that we stop acting, or we hide from that reality, which is just part of us. We're unwilling to take account for that, and so we wait for somebody else to get busy and make the world better, because I got to deal with the fact that I'm a chicken and a phony and a slob. That's the difficult news of judgment. But the good news is that we're loved and that we're called to our work anyway. There are no perfect people who are going to come along and make it all better. It's going to be a bunch of slobs and chickens and phonies who are going to look themselves in the mirror and each other and say, well, we got to get on with this, and find company in their brokenness, right? Because not only are we seeing some of the hard truths about ourselves in the mirror, we also can see that we're cherished and forgiven,
bleeding to be sure, but also bled for by a love that doesn't give up on us. And that love further says that in spite of our sin, to use an old-fashioned word, extraordinary things will still happen for us and will still happen through us and will still happen with us and by us. According to Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, our principal work as followers of Jesus is to be agents of reconciliation. But given how difficult it is to get ourselves and our relationships going in the right direction, sometimes it's a wonder that we ever try. So if we let it, it can be life-changing to be forgiven, and maybe even more so to forgive others. But it's so hard to look at ourselves in the mirror that we often don't get around to this primary work with ourselves, with our families, or the other systems that we inhabit. Yet, if we have eyes to see it, the face looking back at us is the face of God, who loves what he sees there, even as he judges our actions and calls us to love more than we think is possible. We're called to this work of reconciliation. Now, what would it be like if the Republicans and the Democrats reconciled with each other? Can you imagine it? We can't anymore. We're called to this work of reconciliation. What would it be like if people of every race reconciled to each other? What would it be like if the poor and the wealthy worked through the pain of that imbalance and we began to reconcile our differences? You see, the creation of community and right relationship with each other, it's not an activity that we can choose to get around to when we can find some time and resources to get to it. Being radically connected in this way is what life is for, if I understand Paul correctly. Reconciliation is the spiritual and moral discipline which makes loving and respectful relations between people possible, says one theologian, especially when there are dramatic differences or bad blood between us. And if we take a page out of the parable of the prodigal son, being reconciled is what love looks like and what love feels like. And it's just as hard as the story suggests. It's the most challenging work in my experience, and the best, because it heals us. And through that, then, we can become those who help others to heal. And although it's impossible for anybody to leave behind fully the darkness of our experiences and of the world that we carry around on our backs like a snail, but God makes even that burden a blessed possibility. Henry Ward Beecher is a death-dealing cheater. There's no way around it. But he manages to keep bringing the gospel to life for people anyway, and maybe he can even at times hear the good news of the gospel himself. Lear goes berserk on a heath, but comes out of it for a few brief hours every inch a king. Zacchaeus climbs up a sycamore tree, a crook, and he climbs down a saint. Paul sets out as a hatchet man for the Pharisees, and he comes back as Jesus' biggest fan and advocate. God's healing, reconciling work is clearly more powerful than we are. What do you see in the mirror? And what transforming work are you called to get on with? Maybe it all begins with being forgiven ourselves and believing that we're loved and useful in spite of our shortcomings or peccadilloes or our likeliness to hurt ourselves or each other. It begins within, when a person's inner need to be cared for and understood is met in an encounter with the living God. And so this experience of being reconciled becomes the ground and moral mandate for integrating our inner and outer selves, and then doing the same with our families and our neighbors and our enemies and a stranger and the world. Amen.